Good morning, everyone, and welcome. Judge Hamilton and I are pleased and delighted this morning to welcome the Honorable J.P. Stettmiller of the Eastern District of Wisconsin, who has kindly consented to help us out this morning with our cases. Thank you for being here, and thank you for participating. With that, we'll call the first case of this morning, which is Swanigan v. City of Chicago, case number 12-1261.
May it please the Court, the plaintiff is seeking de novo review of the summary dismissal of a Monell claim. I'd like to spend time discussing the substance of plaintiff's Monell claim, but I'd first like to discuss some procedural aspects to the case. My first point is that plaintiff was ambushed by the Court in its dismissal of the Monell claim. There was no responsive pleading filed by the city, no motion to dismiss a complaint, either for lack of jurisdiction or failure to state a claim before the Court. All there was before the Court was a motion to lift the stay. It was plaintiff's motion to lift the stay. Yet the Court dismissed the complaint, concluding that the complaint contained no actual case or controversy, and it failed to state a claim. This is more or less a sua sponte decision on the part of the Court. What was before the Court was our motion to lift the stay, and also the city's response, which was, we have a certificate of entry of judgment. Without admitting municipal liability, we're willing to indemnify the individuals and pay $1 in nominal damages.
What is a certificate of entry of judgment?
It was a form that was just made up by the city.
Does it have any cognate under the civil rules of procedure? It's not a Rule 68 office.
No. It was something that was made up by the city, and they said that we will agree to pay the damages that were awarded by the jury in the first trial, in the first action against the individuals, and we will, in addition, pay $1 in nominal damages. They did not admit liability, but they said this will, in effect, eliminate any actual case or controversy. So, as I said, we were ambushed. The plaintiff was ambushed in the dismissal of the Monell claim. The Monell claim had been stayed for 3 years. The related action against the individual officers went to trial. Court issued a final judgment against the individual officers. And after that happened, we moved to lift the stay. There had only been a complaint filed. Even the responsive pleading had been stayed. And the court decided to dismiss the complaint. Another point I want to make is that throughout this whole action, and even through this appeal, the city of Chicago has not been willing to admit liability, that their practices and policies have led to plaintiffs' constitutional injuries. The court below and the city of Chicago both confuse Monell claim with indemnification. When the complaint was first filed, the court decided that it was a related claim and reassigned it. In that same order, which is in Appendix 5, it asked the court to agree to indemnify the individual officers to eradicate the Monell claim.
There's nothing wrong with that procedure, is there? It can save a lot of time. Gets money in the plaintiff's pocket if he's got a good claim against the individual officers, right?
Your Honor, what's at stake here is the future viability of the Monell claim.
There's a lot at stake here, but where we've got individual plaintiffs who are individual defendants held liable, full compensatory damages paid, tell me what is the practical difference between what the city was offering to do and what you want.
Well, the whole city's whole argument on standing here is based on the assertion that the actions complained of, the injuries suffered by the plaintiff, and the remedies in the Monell claim are coextensive with those with the individual officers, and they are not. There are differences in the parties involved, the scope of the conduct, the duration of the injuries, and the remedies that the plaintiff is seeking, because we're seeking equitable remedies.
In that regard, Ms. Dagmar, specifically, what are the equitable remedies that are left in this case, particularly against the backdrop of the Lyons case and the Davis cases?
Well,
I'm having trouble getting my arms around really what's left in this case other than principles.
Well, we're contending they're both equitable injuries, or remedies, and also compensatory. I will talk about the equitable remedy.
But your clients have already been compensated.
I can. Do you want me to talk about that? I can jump to the compensatory. Let me speak first of the equitable. Plaintiffs entitled to declaratory and injunctive relief because of the continuing existence of official police records that identify him as a robber. The city has failed to create a mechanism to challenge false police reports in a gross situation such as this. Plaintiffs should be able to expunge those records. That's Los Angeles County versus Humphreys. Plaintiff in that case asked for damages, an injunction, and a declaration that the government had deprived them of their constitutional rights by failing to create a mechanism by which they could contest inclusion in a child abuse index, child abuse registry. The Ninth Circuit said that the Fourth Amendment required the state to provide those on the list with notice and with a hearing, and therefore plaintiffs were entitled to declaratory relief. That when it went up to the Supreme Court, it was a much narrower issue. So the Supreme Court let the county off the hook because it said this is a state policy, the state is liable, but the county's not liable. But it did not do anything to impede the ability of a plaintiff to say there's no mechanism by which we can challenge this. And that's a due process violation. We don't know all the records that are out there because we were not allowed to have discovery on any of the issues pertaining to the city of Chicago. We were narrowed, we were limited in what we could do for discovery, and it had to do with the individual defendants we could identify. And we kept on identifying. This was a discovery in the case involving the individual officers. It was a protracted discovery. I mean, it was like pulling teeth. We were finding out, okay, though this officer was involved, this officer was involved. Well, wasn't the FBI involved?
If I could interrupt, I recognize that there was some perhaps prematurity in what happened here, to put it generously. But the question remains, what is analogous about the injury to your client from the clear clothes policy, which is the subject, a primary subject of your complaint, and a sex offender registry, for example, in terms of the injury? It seems to me it's just reputational only, which isn't generally enough.
It's not only reputational. We do know that there's at least one report out there that does identify him as the Popeye restaurant armed robber, identifies him as the hard hat bandit who was involved in numerous bank robberies.
The report says that he was identified in lineups. Isn't that what the report says? That was cleared and closed, or that cleared and closed the case, I should say. It says that he was identified in lineups. It doesn't say that he's the hard hat bandit.
It does identify him as the offender. It does identify him as, the case was closed and solved, and from the perspective of the police, solved with him being identified. It was the assistant state's attorney that says, you don't have a case. And so, it didn't go forward. But that's not what the police report, the police report identifies him as the offender. And as I said, we don't know what other reports may be out there. He was subjected to numerous lineups for drug cases, theft cases, assault cases. We don't know, what else he was involved in. Now, if we were allowed to amend the complaint, we would allege that a routine traffic stop is a common experience for all motorists, especially so in the plaintiff's neighborhood, which is the police like to call a high-crime neighborhood. It's routine to run a background check. It's reasonable to assume that check, at a minimum, is going to put him under additional scrutiny. What is on that database when the police go to their computer? Because they will go to their computer when they do a traffic stop. They'll go to their computer. Does it indicate that he was detained as an armed robber, that he was arrested as an armed robber, that the case was solved with him being identified as the armed robber? We don't know what that database says, but we know that this is not a remote situation like Lyons, which is what the original question was. The court was concerned that they said that there would be no injunction because the threat of prosecution hinges on a highly attenuated claim of speculative future events. But it was not the possibility of a future traffic stop that was speculative in the Supreme Court's eyes. It was that Los Angeles police would always, in all future stops, all police officers would always choke a citizen with whom they happen to have an encounter.
I thought the issue there was the plaintiff would have to resist again and be subjected to the chokehold. So it was a very remote occurrence.
Right.
How old is Mr. Swanigan?
He's in his 30s.
His 30s, okay. Person of color?
Yes.
Living in a high crime area?
Yes.
Names in the database as police believe he's guilty of an armed robbery. And your contention is that with those allegations, it would be plausible that there would be a substantial risk that he would be stopped again and subjected to the hold past court call.
No, not that he would be subjected. He might be, it would increase the delay of his stop, possibly. At worst, he would be detained for investigation and possibly brought in, because police have a lot of discretion as to whether they arrest somebody when there's a traffic stop or when there isn't one, as we know from this case, because they did arrest him. We don't know if there's an investigative alert on a police database. We don't know whether there's an indication may be armed. We don't know the result of these police reports and what the police can look at in their computers if they happen to stop him. We're not saying that he is going to be detained for more than 48 hours again. We're not saying that. We're saying he's likely to, just as anybody is likely to be stopped for a traffic stop, they will go to their computer and do a background check, and this is going to pop up. And so shouldn't he...
The injury underlying the Monell claim, insofar as it relates to the cleared clothes policy and the remedy of injunctive relief of expungement, I take it. I mean, that's the line of analysis here.
Yes, there should be a process by which someone can contest an erroneous police report that names you as an armed robber when it in a gross situation like this.
Presumably the police in a city like Chicago are going to investigate a lot of different crimes. Some are going to be solved, some are not.
Sure.
Does somebody who was interviewed by the police have a right, in connection with the crime, have a right to go in a couple of years later and say, I'd like to see your files. I want to see what it says about me because I'm worried that you guys think bad things about me and that something bad is going to happen to me. You're saying this is a gross situation, but I'm trying to figure out how broadly that principle would apply to a kind of Freedom of Information Act access of interested parties to police files and a kind of sanitizing of them.
I suppose it's the same thing as saying with this child abuse registry that was the Supreme Court dealt with in the case it had, that anybody could contest being on the child abuse index. Could be thousands of people. This particular person said, I should never have been on this index.
Right,
and there's got to be a mechanism by which you can challenge
that. That's a formal database that was accessible to quite a few people, right? Is it publicly accessible?
I imagine it would have been.
Okay, and we're talking about internal police investigative files. I mean, we're getting down to if a detective writes in a notebook, I think this is the guy. Is there a right to expunge then?
This was a situation where there, as we said, there was no probable cause to arrest him.
I understand the allegations you're talking about here, and I understand you think it's a really egregious case. I'm trying to understand whether it would be possible to rule in your favor without also creating, in essence, a kind of de facto Freedom of Information Act for access to detectives' notebooks.
We now have Freedom of Information Act where you can of course get these records. Employers can get these records, creditors can get
police
these records.
Police investigative files?
They can get these police reports. Anybody can just go and make a Freedom of Information Act request using his name, using a date, using enough identifying features.
So I could go in today and ask for this report that identifies him as the Popeye robber?
Yes, you could. You could, as could any creditor and any employer, any private citizen can do that. So it is publicly accessible. And so I think it's a direct parallel with the child abuse index. We're also saying that, I see I'm going into my rebuttal time, but I do want to mention a couple things quickly. Plaintiff's entitled to declaratory judgment that this whole past court call policy is unconstitutional. It's an egregious policy. It has to end. It's been going on for 30 years. It's been contested in a number of cases. The initial arresting officers expected no scrutiny or discipline for arresting the plaintiff. They knew that they were going to render the plaintiff to the detectives. Normally, when you've got a traffic stop, first of all, there doesn't even need to be an arrest. If there's an arrest, there's preset bail. You go to the police station, and you're out on an I-bond. With a traffic charge, you have to give your driver's license, but you're out on an I-bond. You're not detained for 3 or 4 hours to enable the detectives to put a hold on you and then being held indefinitely when there's no probable cause. And this is a policy that plaintiff's entitled to declaratory judgment, and if not an injunction against the police department against continued use. He is also entitled to, the plaintiff's entitled to compensatory damages here against the city that are outside. This is not a double-dipping situation, and I can talk to that later.
How is it not? What damages, what compensable injury has he suffered that hasn't already been compensated?
The Monell claim is broader than the action against the individual officers. The whole pass court call policy has a more expansive impact. The trial was for detention for more than 48 hours. We received summary judgment on four of the defendants, and then there were four additional defendants, three of the four the jury found liability on, for detention and an unreasonable length of detention. The arresting officers, Trotter and Mulfelder, were found not liable on the arrest. That does not mean that the city is not liable for compensatory damages. That's the Thomas versus Cook County Sheriff case that said that even when individual employees are not responsible, the medical technicians were not deliberately indifferent, but the policy had led them to the arrest. So
There's something I'm missing here. Sorry. But I thought the arrest was held constitutional. It was the detention and the use made of him during the detention that you were challenging.
The jury found for the defendants on the arrest claim, the two officers who had arrested him. My point. The motive of arresting officers is not relevant for the determination of probable cause. However, the motive of arresting officers to arrest a plaintiff for bank robberies for which there is no probable cause and the driving force and tool that allows this to happen is the existence of a policy that permits detectives to hold the arrestee by a stroke of a pen, then the city is liable. They're liable for a widespread custom and practice that allows arresting officers to know, to think that they can arrest somebody.
But insofar as the compensatory remedy is concerned for your client, setting aside declaratory and injunctive relief, the injury from the unlawful detention claim that was tried is the same as the injury that underlies the whole policy claim against the city under Monell. The compensatory injury.
My first point, there are three ways in which compensatory injuries can be lodged against the city. One is what I've just mentioned, that the arrest itself is compensable, even though the officers were found not liable. Second, the compensatory damages from the city for what the unknown officers did to the plaintiff while he was in custody. He was involved in multiple lineups. There were people we don't even know about that had put him in lineups for robbery, drug, assault, theft investigations. The city is responsible for what everyone else did to him. So while he got compensation.
Are the lineup claims analytically different from the hold policy claim? Is that a different claim or is that a different injury?
We're saying that there are compensatory damages against the city that should be available to the plaintiff beyond what he got in a claim that he was detained more than 48 hours. He did not receive compensation for what was done to him by unknown officers. And those are in the nature of a due process violation that we weren't even able to get to and get.
Being put in a lineup is a due process violation?
When your body is being used and you're
we know he was being held unconstitutionally long mm-hmm. for those purposes, but he's been paid for those, right?
He's been paid for the detention of more than 48 hours. He's not been paid by what happened to him by unknown officers who subjected him to multiple lineups.
I'm struggling with the idea that that is a distinct injury.
We're contending that it is, because the injury that he was compensated for was for identified officers and what they did to him during that period of time. There are also unidentified officers who pulled him into various lineups and subjected him to those investigations, and we don't even know what they were, that it is compensable against the city. And then the third, compensatory damages, we're saying is for the continued injuries he has as a result of the public records identifying him as a bank robber. That's also a compensatory damage claim against the city. And I'm hoping the court will give me a couple more minutes on rebuttal. Thank you.
Ms. Masters.
May it please the Court. This case is about a district judge's authority to manage her docket and whether a plaintiff has standing to pursue double recovery and redress for speculative harms. The dispute in this case begins with issues of docket management and imposing unwarranted expense upon the defendant. Mr. Swanigan, 15 days before the close of discovery and 2 months before dispositive motions were due, moved to add, let's be clear here, it was 11 different policy claims to the litigation that had already been started. The district court rejected the attempt to add what would have basically been a fourth complaint to the matter. The district court agreed that this would be an unwarranted change in focus and expansion of the litigation at the last minute and denied the request to amend to add the Monell claims. In an attempt to end run that ruling, Mr. Swanigan initiated a new action, again setting forth 11 different policy claims. The proposition of litigating the same matter in two courts was wasteful of the party's time and this court's and the court's resources, and the court properly consolidated the two matters pursuant to local rules and the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And in keeping with its earlier ruling to deny amendment, the district court stayed the Monell claims and asked the city to stipulate to indemnification, which we did. The other claims went to trial. After the trial on the merits, on the two remaining claims against the individual defendants, which were false arrest and the hold policy that was used, or the hold claim against the individual officers. And by the way, there were unknown officers also named in that initial complaint. There were 20 individual defendants, and then there were additional unknown officers who were named. Those claims were resolved. And Mr. Swanigan went to lift the stay. Now, let me be clear on a few different points regarding lifting the stay. First of all, Mr. Swanigan clearly articulated that he was only moving to lift the stay on two policies. That was the cleared-closed policy and the hold policy. Now, the district court, even in its opinion, notes this and notes that Mr. Swanigan had other policy claims which he did not move to lift the stay on, and that he specifically stated that he was going to narrow his claims that he was going to proceed on in the Monell claim.
Well, I don't know that it's correct to characterize the motion to lift the stay as being exclusive to two claims. It wasn't on its face limited to that. It was a global motion to lift the stay to file an amended complaint, and counsel represented that there would be an effort to narrow the claims based on what had occurred during the trial, but I don't read the motion as exclusive to the hold claim and the cleared close claim, even though those were the focus. It's just a motion to lift the stay on the Monell claim against the city. And so to interpret it as limited in scope, it seems to me, is to impose a limitation that just isn't there.
Your Honor, I will. I understand your point. Our argument stems from the reply that the plaintiff filed. It's R22 in the record, and I'll read it to you. It says, at this point in the litigation, having been through both discovery and trial of the individual plaintiffs, plaintiff submits that a viable case or controversy remains as to the constitutionality of two policies of the City of Chicago that were the moving force, and then identifies the hold passport call procedure and the cleared closed case procedure. So that is certainly the basis of our claim.
That was a response to your argument that there was no longer a case or controversy, right?
Well, it is in response.
Which was an objection lodged against the lifting of the stay. I mean, this whole thing was procedurally unorthodox. I think that has to be conceded.
Your Honor, we would concede that it was not procedurally textbook, but what we would make the point to the court about is that plaintiff has not identified what substantive response was not given. So plaintiff moves to lift the stay. We say your claims are no longer viable. And I also would refer the court to R17 at 1, which is the motion to lift the stay that also says that the motion to lift the stay is directed at two alleged unconstitutional policies.
Well, it says that the plaintiff intends to narrow the complaint in its next iteration, but it doesn't say this motion is limited in that sense. It's just a representation of what a forthcoming amended complaint might focus on, but you know, nobody ever got there because of the preemption of the judge's decision, essentially interpreting your response to the plaintiff's motion as a motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. At least that's how I interpret it.
Well,
is that a fair interpretation of what went on?
Your Honor, we would disagree with that. We think that there are waiver issues. We think if you go before a district court and say, I am seeking to only lift the stay on two claims, then that's what you're doing, and the remaining claims you're not going to.
It doesn't say that they're waiving the other aspects of the claim that were then remaining in the original complaint. That original complaint was not taken off the table. The only complaint that the court had in front of it, which it dismissed, had all kinds of different claims in it, including the line of claims and others that have been mentioned here today.
It did, but we do believe that the plaintiff, I mean, our interpretation is that the plaintiff clearly called to the court's attention that the plaintiff was only going to pursue two claims by saying there are only two viable claims left. And so that to us is a clear indication that the other claims are off the table. And certainly plaintiff should have moved for reconsideration then. When the district court says, well, there are no other claims that you're pursuing, and specifically in its opinion has a footnote saying even plaintiff brought.
Where in this motion does it say that I intend to pursue only two claims? It says plaintiff intends to amend the complaint in order to narrow the issues consistent with the jury verdict and seek leave to amend the remedies portion in order to clarify that in addition to damages, we're also seeking declaratory and injunctive relief. So, you know, it's clearly a representation that counsel intends to focus the claims, but it's not a waiver or a withdrawal of any claim that was in the original complaint.
We believe the language in the reply which is R22, which says plaintiff submits that a viable case or controversy remains as the constitutionality of two policies does concede that the other policy claims are not viable and are not going to be pursued. That is our take on that. In terms of being ambushed, we would state that the plaintiff wasn't ambushed. The plaintiff, as I've just read from that excerpt from the reply, responded on the merits and then briefs whether or not there is a viable case as to cleared, closed, or hold policy. And frankly, again, if the plaintiff wanted to pursue these other policy claims, that would have been the time to say it. I mean, the plaintiff is saying there are no other viable policy claims.
Ms. Masters, could we talk briefly about this, what I see as the larger issue here, which has to do with district judges' ability to manage individual defendant 1983 claims and Monell claims. Bifurcation works when the plaintiff is trying to get money in his pocket, right? You all indemnify pursuant to Illinois state law, and I understand how that procedure works if the plaintiff is willing to go along with it. What I don't understand is what is a certification of entry of judgment? Where does that fit in the federal rules of civil procedure? How does it differ from a Rule 68 offer or simply a default judgment against the city on those claims?
Your Honor, I don't have the answer in the Rule 68 question for you. What it is in line with is some of the cases that plaintiff has cited, such as Amato or Larez from other circuits, where the plaintiff is saying, the defendant is saying, mm-hmm. you're not entitled to any other compensatory damages. You are entitled to $1. We are for nominal damages. We are offering you $1. Mm-hmm. Here's the $1. And there's other authority in the circuit which says you can't litigate when you have been offered what you are, that okay. to which you are entitled.
Let's talk about Amato, though, okay? Because, as you'll recall, the Second Circuit said, no, that doesn't end the case. Judge and allowed the plaintiff to go forward seeking only nominal damages on the Monell claim. Now, if I recall, it was Judge Jacobs who wrote a separate opinion there saying, well, what the city ought to do is just allow a default to be entered against it on the Monell claim. What's wrong with that? Why doesn't that take care of your concerns?
To allow a default to mm-hmm. be entered against us?
Mm-hmm. For $1 in nominal damages.
Your Honor, I think the answer to that is an alternative. It's just not what happened here. Here we went in. And one of the reasons...
Well, it is a recognizable creature under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. A certification of entry of judgment is something I don't recognize at all, particularly when it doesn't actually result in entry of judgment in favor of the plaintiff, but instead results in dismissal of the case.
Well, to be clear, one of the backups that happened here is the plaintiff in his motion to lift the stay said he would be willing to consider a compromise once the stay was lifted, and so we responded and said, well, here, we'll pay you your $1. Here's the certification of judgment. So that's sort of procedurally how this came about and why we would not have just said, let me
but
get a default judgment.
The way
judgment.
You do that is a Rule 68 offer, right?
Right. Well, I think that the court considered this a Rule 68 in substance and said, here's your dollar. Or we
okay,
could go
wait,
back.
Wait a second, though. If a Rule 68 offer is not accepted, though it disappears except for purposes of costs and fees, so why not just accept it? If you were treating it as a Rule 68 offer, why not just accept it?
I'm not sure I understand
your
question.
Well, let me go. I guess what I'm trying to get, and haven't heard from either side at this point, is what the practical differences are between a Rule 68 offer, a default judgment against the city on the Monell claims, and this creature, this certification of entry of judgment that seems to be turned upside down and becomes entry of judgment against the plaintiff.
Your Honor, I would make two responses.
Why do you care is what I want to know.
Mm-hmm. Why do we
care about those differences?
Your Honor, frankly, I would have to go back to my client and find out whether we would care. We didn't.
We're spending an awful lot of time and energy on the differences here, and I don't understand the differences, and you're telling me you don't know why it's important to you.
We did not brief Rule 68. It did not come up. So I will submit supplemental authority down. At the bottom line, though, is that we offered the $1 in nominal damages, and plaintiff isn't here saying I want to pursue my $1. Plaintiff wants to go pursue a lot more than $1, and the fact of the matter is that plaintiff is not entitled to any other compensatory damages. And we cited in our brief to the jury instructions, and I want to make a few points. One, the jury instructions made in the individual liability case made clear that what was being pursued is this hold policy. The jury instructions stated the police may not arrest on one charge and then prolong detention on that charge for purpose of gathering additional information against the plaintiff on an unrelated charge. We have the citation to that in our brief. So the jury was instructed in the individual defendant on this hold policy claim, although it wasn't called the hold policy, but it was instructed on the substance on the hold. There are other allegations that plaintiff has made in the reply brief in here today about not having discovery. I took a quick look after reading the reply brief at the docket in the 07 case, initial 07 case against the individual defendants. And we were ordered, for example, in a docket number R85 in a motion to compel To the extent that defendant can produce other records of lineups where plaintiff was a suspect, the defendant is to produce those records by the close of discovery. There are all types of allegations that the plaintiff is making about not having documents, not having access to information. This case went on for 4 or 5 years and was litigated to trial. What plaintiff at most doesn't have is documents about the extent of policies, but the plaintiff is not lacking documents as to injuries to himself, as to impact upon himself. Those were turned over in the individual litigation. And so plaintiff is not entitled to another go-round because perhaps the plaintiff could think of something else to say against the city here. The plaintiff has gotten his compensatory damages. The claims as to injunctive relief as to the hold policy or the third closed policy all begin with speculation of I might be arrested again.
Let me ask you about that. One of the consequences of the procedural irregularities or unorthodoxies here is that we're dealing with a pre-Iqbal complaint that defendant or plaintiff rather has never had the opportunity to amend to, as I understand it, to bring up to Iqbal standards, whatever they might be. So as a result, we've got to give the plaintiff a lot of flexibility with respect to allegations and assertions of facts that he thinks he might be able to prove. Suppose the plaintiff could show, as a young man in his 30s, at least I like to think that's young, in a high-crime neighborhood, who knows that there's this negative information about him in police files. It's, say, greater than 50% likelihood over the next 10 years he's going to be encountering police in a routine traffic stop and will be subjected to unjustified detention as a result. Would that justify injunctive relief?
Your Honor, no, it would not, because it would still be entirely speculative. And here's why.
Greater than 50% possibility?
It's still entirely speculative, and the reason why is because he's saying, I'm going to be stopped. That's your 50%, as I understand your hypothetical. Mm-hmm. But then he's got to also show that he's going to likely be suspected of other wrongdoing.
The police will run a background check on him, see that other police officers concluded he's guilty of armed bank robbery, although never adjudicated as such, and that the police are going to treat him that way in various ways. And you know, and all of us who see 1983 cases in large numbers know what the police can do with somebody they suspect under those circumstances. They have a lot of discretion, and he'll be targeted.
Your Honor, our response to that is that is still entirely speculative because you're speculating on the arrest.
Is it implausible?
The standard for no. I mean, the answer is in your hypothetical, it is not implausible given your statistics. But let me make a few points. Plausibility is not the test for standing. You've got to show likely injury, and you have to sell. I mean, I believe in your analogy, it's still stating basically, like in Lyons, and I might be subject to a chokehold again. Maybe, maybe not. I mean, it's still entirely speculative.
These would be practices that are far more routine. I mean, in Lyons, the problem was that the plaintiff would have to have been not only arrested again, but would have had to resist in order to provoke a chokehold. That's what was unduly speculative. Here we're talking about very foreseeable consequences of a routine traffic stop.
Your Honor, we believe those are speculative and hypothetical.
Let me ask,
and they're not.
How can the district judge evaluate that possibility given the state of this record on that claim for injunctive relief?
Because, Your Honor, the plaintiff had years to look into this. If the plaintiff wanted to add that claim about statistics or whatever he could have alleged that in the first instance. He could have called it to the court's attention. If he thinks it's 50%, he could have called it to the court's attention. In this brief where he has alleged additional facts, he's just saying it's highly likely.
There was no opportunity to amend the complaint, though. The Monell claim was raised in the new complaint under a different pleading regime and was stayed. So the allegations were essentially frozen in time at that moment, and all the plaintiff was asking for was a lifting of the stay in order to file a new complaint that would flesh out some of these claims and potentially narrow them for purposes of moving the case along toward a resolution, and wasn't permitted to do so. So evaluating the standing and mootness and case and controversy issues without the benefit of a new iteration of the complaint that would focus the claims is really exceedingly difficult in the first place and unfair to the plaintiff, because it was the only complaint that was before the court was the original one, which was frozen, as I said, in time at when it was stayed.
Your Honor, I mean, the problem with some of these hypotheticals, though, and I think even to your point, is that the courts are supposed to assume that people behave in a lawful manner. And so the plaintiff wants to come in and say, I am likely to be arrested again. That's not a permissible assumption. And so, I mean, I see my time is up, but just to wrap it up, the plaintiff does not have standing to pursue hypothetical claims of injury. If the plaintiff is ever arrested again, then the plaintiff could bring that claim. But at the moment, to hypothesize, I may be arrested again, which is the basis of all of these claims, we urge the court to affirm. Plaintiff has raised a lot of issues that we think are not substantiated by the record, so we urge affirmance based on our brief and what has said here today.
All right, thank you. Ms. Dimkar, we kept you at the podium long after your light went on, so you can have an additional 2 minutes to rebut.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, how the court decides this case could be the death knell to Monell claims. Monell is supposed to provide a direct cause of action against a municipality and to deter unconstitutional policies and procedures. If you lose a case, if you bifurcate
you're exaggerating this a good bit, okay? Because Monell claims, for example, will, even apart from this, retain a very important role in situations in which individual defendants may be entitled to qualified immunity, for example, acting pursuant to a municipal or local policy or custom. So that's going to remain, right?
Right.
Okay.
It'll still be alive there. Right. I guess my point was, if you lose the case against individual officers, if there's a bifurcation, the city's going to argue there's no Monell claim because there's no underlying constitutional violation. That's tempered somewhat by the Thomas versus Cook County Sheriff's case. If you win the case against individual officers, they're going to say that, you know, there's no Monell claim because you already got your relief. But we're saying that the Monell claim here is far more expansive than what was pursued against individual officers. And I do want to say one thing about this Rule 68 offer and, you know, what was troubling you, Judge Hamilton, that the city sought to avoid accountability for its actions by stipulating to a sham. It has to indemnify the officers. So their agreeing to indemnify the officers is nothing. And the judge was saying the same thing. The city was saying the same thing. And we're saying, no, we're not looking for an indemnification because you've got to indemnify them. We're looking for liability on the city's part. And so, you know, we're asking the court to look at the policies and procedures that we're trying to reform here. And that's the purpose of the Monell claim. We should have been able to proceed. And this was a summary dismissal of a complaint. We're asking the court to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.